I woke up this morning to Chuck Woolery. Chuck Woolery trending on Twitter. And, you know, I thought of him as some game show host with big hair. That's what I remember of Chuck Woolery. Evidently, he's some rabid right-winger now, which didn't know. Tells you what I know. I thought, Chuck Woolery, trending. Maybe he died. I was ready to send out thoughts and prayers. Turns out he only said something really stupid. Evidently, he claims that racism has nothing to do with race. It's the progressive left who needs attention, according to him. It's all them. If you disagree with them, then you're a racist. And I'm going, no, you're a racist. If you're a racist, that's pretty simple, Chuck. Doesn't get any simpler than that. Anyway, here to talk about all of the events of the big day and much, much more, I've asked our good friend Sarah Kenzior to come talk with us. Sarah is a best-selling author of the book The View from Flyover Country, another one coming out here very, very soon. She's also the co-host of the fantastic podcast Gaslit Nation. Sarah, thanks for taking time for us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So racism has nothing to do with race, Sarah. Nothing.
Yeah, I don't even know where to begin to discuss that. I mean, basically, the main thing that I guess I got out of that is a reaction to the New York Times' series on 1619, which has caused this mass conservative freak out, which is fairly predictable. I also think the Times, I think the project is very admirable. I'm glad it's getting read, glad it's getting attention. I also think the Times uses it to justify their own institutional racism and white supremacy. But, Chuck Woolery, man, I didn't know who he was. I just only knew him as a racist dude on Twitter.
He was a game show host. I didn't know
he had a career before, so this is new to me.
But something like Match Game or something. I have to look it up.
Before my time.
Yeah,
you know,
it was before your time. Yeah, I was just a little kid. Yeah, I was just a little kid at the time. But I saw that. I'm going, wow, did he die? And I'm like, oh no, he just said something stupid. So I figured I'd start off with that. And speaking of something stupid, evidently Trump has postponed a meeting with Denmark's leader over the Greenland comments. Evidently, Denmark doesn't think that Greenland should be sold.
Yeah, I mean, this is honestly not as stupid and as light as I think people believe it is. I know it seems bizarre. It seems like a, Bond villain comic book movie sort of scenario. But basically, Trump and his backers' interest in Greenland, it's not just performative. They are interested in Arctic countries. They're interested in profiting off of the ravages of climate change. They're not actually climate change skeptics or denialists. They believe in it. They know it's coming. They want to accelerate it, and they want to profit off it. And by this, I don't just mean Trump and Kushner and his family, but people like Putin, who have a vested economic interest in this, and of course it benefits him enormously. If climate change goes the way it does in terms of where Russia is geographically situated, there are people like Pompeo who have both an economic interest in this, and also, these are rapture fiends. These are guys who base their policy around the rapture. So if the world is going to basically end for the majority of, Earth's population, that's not a problem for them. They've wrapped that into their religious fanaticism, and they see themselves as the chosen few who get to benefit off of the destruction of the Earth, and they're planning for that in a number of ways. So I think this Greenland thing, as absurd and asinine as it comes off, is actually at heart serious. I think this is kind of a trial balloon he's throwing out there. We know that, Trump does not have any normal conception of sovereignty. He doesn't have any conception of being loyal to the United States, of being a president for the United States. States to him and to his circle, they're just things that people sell. And the more chaotic things get during climate change, the more that's going to become, I think, common practice. And we're seeing the first flashes of it in the West. And so you know, we're in for bad times. And I think that this is one of those things that seems so insane that people don't want to look at the gravity of it, but it's necessary, like every facet of it, the climate change facet, the criminality of it, the religious fanaticism of it, the loss of our traditional alliance between the United States and, you know, European countries like Denmark. All of that is in jeopardy, and people need to take it seriously, but unfortunately our officials on the whole are not.
Now, I first said, hey, if you can get Greenland, it's got a lot of mineral resources. You know, it's strategically, if you put a big military base there, which I guess we already have one. Yeah, if you can get it, yeah. But they're not going to sell because I don't know that they're for sale at all. This is what the leader of Denmark said. You know, it's not for sale. It's absurd. So my first thought when I saw them canceling it is, uh-oh, are we expecting an invasion anytime soon? Or we just take it?
I think there's unlikely to be some sort of traditional on-the-ground invasion of Denmark, like the way we invaded Iraq or Afghanistan or something. I could very easily see a situation in which Denmark, or just, you know, Western Europe in general, is economically devastated, is bankrupted, or is taken over, just as Italy has been, by a fascist, you know, by somebody who is willing to perhaps sell Trump Greenland in return for special favors, in return for, you know, perhaps a piece of territory that they want. Like, the old rules are not going to apply, you know, unless, of course, we manage to get all these psychopaths out of office. But, you know, all these old ideas of alliances, protocols, regulations, how trade is made, like, it needs to go out the window in the sense of envisioning the future. It should not go out the window in terms of how we actually do things, you know, in reality, but we should try to get inside their heads and predict what they're going to do next. Because, yeah, of course, Greenland is not for sale, but we don't know who's going to be running Denmark in the future. We don't know what kind of obstacles they're going to be facing. You know, we've had a very tumultuous last half a decade, and I think it's about to get, you know, a lot more so. So I don't know. It's bad. And, you know, one more thing about Greenland, I posted an article about this, is that it's going to benefit economically from climate change in a tremendous way. It's going to benefit in terms of fossil fuels and all sorts of other things that can be sold. And so, you know, this is, if you're looking for a country to buy, Greenland is a fairly smart choice. And I don't think that this necessarily originated from Trump in terms of an idea, because it is, you know, in the sense of it being perverse, it is a smart choice.
No. I mean, he heard that from somewhere.
Yeah.
There's no question about that. So, but again, I just thought it was, at first, you know, like everybody, that's kind of a funny joke. Then I realized they're actually serious about this. I'm going, this is not good. This is the next bit of empire building.
This is the next bit of what now?
Like empire building. We're going back to the colonialism days.
Yes, yeah. It's exactly the same attitude. And that's why, honestly, I think some of this reaction toward, you know, the New York Times, you know, slavery special issue, and, you know, all these, this talk about imperialism and abuse of humans as laborers, like just the sheer inhumanity of it, that's not something they want people dwelling on. They don't want Americans thinking about this. You know, this also plays over, I think, into Israel and, you know, their apartheid practices. Like, they want a colonialist mindset to be something that's widely accepted by Americans, as I think it, you know, it was sort of starting to be more so during the George W. Bush era, until those wars went so disastrously wrong that even early supporters, you know, abandoned them and wanted the U.S. to stay out of them. They want to build that back up. You know, I don't know how successful they're going to be in terms of that. And I'm not quite sure that public opinion even matters to them in the way it's mattered to former presidents. You know,
nope.
Like his ratings are abysmal, and he doesn't care, because I think they think they've figured out another way to win the election.
So do you believe it when he says he's not going to put a big, giant, golden hotel on Greenland?
I mean, that thing, it's a little tactic he does where it seems like a joke and it seems so ridiculous, but it puts the idea in your mind. You know, it puts it in there over and over again. Like, he pounds this Greenland shit into our heads for like a straight week until finally people, you know, they will eventually debate it in the way that I just did. It's going, you know, right now that all the pundits are still in the joke phase, and, you know, a couple week or two, once there's more actual diplomatic fallout or people start really thinking about it and the climate change aspect, then maybe they'll take it seriously. But I don't know. I mean, our officials don't do anything even when they do realize the gravity of the situation. So we shall see.
Yeah. What do you think of his statement today that Russia should be back into the G7, making it obviously the G8? Curious thought on that.
I hadn't heard about that, but that doesn't surprise me at all. Like, Helsinki was just a year ago. We watched him prostrate himself to Putin openly. We've watched all of these machinations since, where he sucks up to the Kremlin and acts as their partner. So, yeah, of course, like, he wants his pal there. Of course, there's no actual sanctions on oligarchs or any actual punishment for interfering in our election. Like, this is just what Trump's doing, and it's not acceptable in any way. But it's very frustrating because it's a predictable kind of comment. And I think, the fact that I didn't hear about it, meaning that it didn't really permeate into the headlines, I think, in the way it might have a year ago, when it might have had some shock value, it shows that people have adjusted to this. And that in itself, is very sad and very dangerous.
Yeah, his argument is that Russia's only out because Putin outsmarted Obama.
Yeah, he's been saying that for a while. He's been saying that since Obama was president. He went on and on about how smart Putin was. And I think that's in part because in 2013, someone in the Russian government, I think, made him a little promise. I mean, that's what he told Fox News in 2014, that they promised him something good in the future and that he's going to be rewarded and that he should be praising Putin. So that's what he did. And, all this is out there. It's very weird to me that it's folks haven't put these pieces together, especially folks named like Mueller. But anyway.
Yeah. So since you brought Mueller into this, it's over, right?
Well, Mueller's part is, yeah. I mean, he unfortunately, it went the way that I thought it would, where it went out with a whimper. He didn't indict. He didn't interview. He didn't fulfill, I think, the mandate of the purview of the investigation, which he kept trying to redefine as narrower and narrower. And of course, people put way too much faith in him and put all their eggs in the Mueller basket. And what's frustrating, of course, some people are like, oh, well, it's not Mueller's fault. He thought Congress would actually do something with his report. And, those folks have a point. This is Congress's fault as well. It's Pelosi's fault as well. And I'm looking at all of these catastrophes playing out. Well, they're all on vacation. And I mean, I don't know. It gives me pause because these are such serious problems. Like, we've been on this precipice. We have people losing their lives over this administration, whether through gun violence, white supremacist violence, children in cages, disasters brought on by climate change. Like, people are dying, and they're so casual about it. And I'm not sure it's as much rooted in malice, although it is on the GOP side for sure, but as in resignation. Like, I feel like it's if they all kind of threw their hands in the air and are like, yeah, we're all dying or our country's dying. Like, what do you want us to do? And they've given up. And it's really frustrating, to see this play out just because the sheer scope of vulnerable people and what our lives are going to look like in the decade to come.
Yeah, I was just reading an article not too long ago. This guy's argument was that, we're now seeing the rise of the kind of internal turmoil not seen since the Civil War. And, because you've seen the rise of these right-wing groups, all these white supremacist groups, these militia types who have always been, under the surface, they've always been there. It's just now you've got the guy in the White House and through a lot of our levers of power who are now outwardly saying, yep, that's us.
Yeah, and I think, other things have changed that facilitated that. I think social media and the internet and the ability of all these different white supremacist groups to reach across borders, both within the United States and outside of it, get funding from each other, get backing from foreign governments. We're losing sort of the concept of sovereignty, and they're retreating into this idea of ethno states. That's what they want. And again, the climate change angle worries me because they're trying to think of a new way basically to divvy up what's left of the world, and that's the way they see it. But white supremacist violence has been on the rise since Obama took office, not because of something Obama did, but because Obama's a black president, and
right.
it turned them all into constant states of rage. And I think people did underestimate this problem. One thing, I don't know whether to be encouraged or just appalled, is, there have been a number of cases of individuals who were caught before they were able to act this week. Like, I think we're up to four. And so on one hand, it's horrifying that you have four wannabe white supremacist mass shooters who are unable to carry out their plots. On the other hand, I'm glad that at least, you know, people are getting caught, that there's someone or some people in the FBI who still seem to care about this issue and are trying to, you know, to protect innocent people, but it may just be an indication of the scale of the problem. You know, we don't know how many new acolytes are out plotting, you know, as we have this conversation.
Yeah, and guns aren't the problem. And as I predicted, nothing is going to get done on guns because guess what? Trump backpedaled on the background checks and the Republicans are scurrying away from the idea of getting anything done on background checks.
Oh, they're not going to do anything. I mean, it's like, yes, of course you should push them to do it, criticize them for doing it. But when I see these little pathetic tweets from the Democrats that are like, oh, my God, you know, can you believe Mitch McConnell's still not acting on guns? I'm like, yes, of course, because I know who he is. I've been watching him for like several decades. I knew exactly what he was going to do. You, of course, should know what he's going to do and have a backup plan. Like, you need to actually have a plan, a plan of action, not just tweeting. Like, it's just, it's nuts to me that they really don't seem to be doing anything more than like me or you. Like, they're just sitting on Twitter bitching about Mitch McConnell, like just a bunch of schmoes. Like, it's so bad. I mean, it's dangerous, and I don't know exactly what the plan or the remedy should be, but that's why I'm not in Congress, because I don't have a plan. So, you know, I'm off the hook. They are not.
If you were in Congress, yeah, I know you wouldn't be on vacation.
I would be back in freaking Congress. I would not have left my goddamn desk if I was there. I mean, these last few years, you know, I keep hoping we'll, like, look back at them someday as, like, oh, my God, you know, what a terrible time. Sort of in the way, like, my grandparents looked back at the Great Depression or World War II, but I don't know. I feel like more we just sort of transitioned into a new awful dimension. And, you know, like the saying is, there's no way out but through. You know, I think that that's true as well. We're never going to, like, go back to what we were before, but I just hope we go forward to something instead of just going, like, straight down into a bottomless chasm, which is how this entire administration has felt.
Yeah, you brought up climate change earlier, and, you know, it made me think of Rex Tillerson when he was the chairman, when he was the head of ExxonMobil. You know, he was one of the first ones to come out and say climate change is real. But we're humans, and we'll adapt. His thing was, we'll adapt. We'll figure it out, and we'll adapt by privatizing, you know, all of our public services. Nestle being the largest water company in the world, with a CEO who doesn't believe water is a human right. We'll sell you as much water as you want. You know, at some point, I fully expect bottles of air. I fully expect everything that we need to be, you know, for sale.
Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, the key word in Rex Tillerson's phrase there is we. Like, people like you and me, we don't get to be in that we. That we is Exxon. That we is CEOs and Trump and millionaires and their families and their children. And the rest of us, I think, are just going to be suffering to fend for ourselves. It's not like this is going to happen overnight, you know, and so in that sense, I think there's still obviously the ability and the obligation to fight back politically, although we're running out of time environmentally, but at least we can take a stand against this kind of grim future, because they truly do not care about the humanitarian consequences. Nope. It's all just opportunism for them.
No, usually when I have you on, we talk about Trump and the end of the country and all the right-wing fascism and all that. But I wanted to get your thoughts on the business roundtable yesterday. I don't know if you saw the story that they've now decided that they're no longer going to only be about maximizing shareholder wealth. They're actually going to care about other stakeholders, like their employees and their suppliers and local communities and other business. They're gonna now care.
Who is now claiming that they care? I did miss this.
The business roundtable. They are the top 200 CEOs in the country who they set their agenda on how business will operate across the country. About 25 years ago, they decided that, actually during the Reagan years, that it was no longer going to be about, you know, communities, that it was no longer about going to be about consumers. It was no longer going to be about the widgets or whatnot that they built. It was all, their business was all about making shares shareholders' money. It was all about maximizing profits, squeezing the quarter until the eagle screamed. And if you had to slash wages, if you had to steal pension benefits, if you had to outsource, if you had to do all those things to maximize shareholder wealth, that's what you did. Well, on Monday, they said, "Well, you know, we've seen the light. We promise we're going to change."
Yeah, I mean, that's one of those things where I'm just kind of like, I'll believe it when I see it. And I guess good that they're saying it. But I mean, you know, in the words of Elizabeth Warren, like, I want a plan. Like, I want to see how this is actually going to happen in action. It's interesting to me, I guess, that they would try to project that kind of image. You know, it sort of gives the assumption that the public has leverage. Maybe they're, I don't know, afraid of boycotts or something.
No, they're afraid of
it. I don't know.
For me, it's, you know, this is the Sanders-Warren effect. This is them going, uh-oh, we better change our image before Democrats take over and hammer the hell out of us with higher taxes and more regulations. And uh-oh, we better be good corporate citizens again, because people are finally waking the hell up that they've been getting screwed for 40 years. As you know, just the other day, we talked with someone from EPI who said from 1978 till today, the CEO class has seen their wages go up 940%, while the average Joe Schmuck on the shop floor, 12%.
Yeah, no, I saw that because I was thinking, God, that's like literally the exact time span of my life, and I know no other reality. But yeah, it is interesting. I do think that there's an effect from Sanders and Warren, and I definitely think people have woken up. I mean, we're now 11 years post-recession. I think most people haven't recovered. There's, of course, all this talk about a forthcoming recession, which I do agree is coming, you know, has been looming. And, you know, we've already suffered fallout from automation, from a retail crisis, from all these other things. And I think the fact that the majority of the country, you know, if you were like born in 78, you're 40 years old, like you've never seen a kind of equitable economic reality. You've just seen things get worse and worse. So when you hear from people like, oh, it's cyclical, or you hear from a corporation, oh, yeah, don't worry, you know, we'll fix our practices, you're going to get cynical and you're going to get angry because you remember all the times that you heard that crap before and, you know, it never panned out. And I think that that's the attraction, you know, of Sanders, of Warren, you know, of other politicians who are very blunt about how bad things are and about the need for, you know, a much broader kind of systemic change than we've ever been given before. You know, I do think most younger people in particular have caught on to that. Older folks, you know, sometimes, you know, they suffer too. They lost pensions. It's not like it was so easy for them. But, you know, I think they just kind of remember having lived through past crises and watch things get better. So they have that memory in their mind. Yep. Whereas, like, you know, I don't personally have that. And people younger than me definitely don't either.
At least they had pensions to lose. That's the other part of it.
Exactly.
Yeah, but you know, the thing is for me, if there's one policy I would love to see, it's Sanders' idea of repealing Taft-Hartley and moving back to the original intent of the National Labor Relations Act. To me, that solves a lot of these problems. And the business roundtable, they could do whatever the hell they want. You give me back the right to strike, secondary boycotts. You give me back those end right to work nonsense. Then you can do whatever you want. Because we'll fight you on the picket lines and at the bargaining table. Last thing I wanted to get from you. Evidently, according to Donald Trump, Jews who vote for Democrats show a lack of knowledge or they're greatly disloyal.
Yeah, that's disgusting. I mean, it's anti-Semitic, and it's anti-Semitic on a number of levels. Like, one of the things that struck me about this comment is, you know, of course this taps into this old anti-Semitic trope of dual loyalty. But what he's talking about here is not loyalty to America. You know, he didn't specify. It's either loyalty to Israel, which Trump has said before that he believes basically that the president, the real president of American Jews is not him, but Netanyahu, because he divides everything, you know, into these kind of ethnic groups. He has this like mafia cult view of the world, you know, that supersedes any kind of national loyalty. So he's either mad because they're not properly loyal to Israel and therefore loyal to a lot of his benefactors like Sheldon Adelson, or they're not loyal to him. You know, they feel like, hey, you know, he's out there moving the capital to Jerusalem. This is clearly the only thing that American Jews could possibly care about in his mind. And so therefore they should be grateful to him. They should be supplicating themselves to him. I mean, it's disgusting in so many ways, and I really hope that people don't let it go, because of course it's an extension of the bigotry that he's shown toward Muslims, that he's shown toward Latinos. You know, he's had kind of a mixed record in terms of his anti-Semitism. You know, he has a lot of kind of, someone described it as philo-Semitism, you know, basically sycophancy towards the Jewish community, but it's just as dehumanizing. You know, he's not recognizing Jewish Americans as equal citizens. He's not thinking the baseline is, of course they're loyal. Like, you know, what kind of question even is that? And so it's heartbreaking to me to see how many, you know, Jewish Americans are on Twitter now, you know, just saying that this week has felt like it's gone on for years and months, you know, that it's just an agonizing thing to see from a president. It's agonizing to have loyalty questioned. Like, I hope people will remember, you know, that he did this and not just forgive and forget, because it's a symptom of a really serious problem.
440 days till Election Day.
God.
So only 440 more days like today, because think about what happened today. I mean, the loving on Putin, the attack on the Jews. Trade wars are easy to win, except for when you have to go to recessions, what we have to do. That's just today.
See, this is the thing, though, is that the time period I'm most frightened of is the day after Election Day and before January, whatever, 20th. When he, say he loses, would leave office. That is going to be the most dangerous time in American history, and I'm just, oh God, I'm so full of dread for that. But at least I'm glad to see the enthusiasm, you know, for the people running against him, all of them. I don't care because I have a preference, it's Warren. But, you know, I'm just glad to see that. I think most Americans really don't want him as the president anymore.
It's
a matter of whether we'll have a free election.
I sure hope you're right, and I hope we vote the bum out. But Sarah, always great talking with you, always fun. I appreciate the time.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you so much, our good friend Sarah Kendzior. Make sure you check out Gaslit Nation, fantastic podcast. Also, her book, The View from Flyover Country, one of the New York Times bestsellers. Quick break, right back. Stick around. Listen to The Rick Smith Show.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.